This is Martha Burke with KSFR's Equal Time. Today I'm talking with Randy McGinn, one of several Democratic candidates for the U.S. House in New Mexico's Congressional District 1. The district serves central New Mexico, including Torrance County, parts of Sandoval, Santa Fe, and Valencia counties, most of Bernalillo County, and almost three-quarters of Albuquerque. Candidates are running to fill the seat formerly occupied by Deborah Howland, who was recently confirmed as U.S. Secretary of the Interior. Randy McGinn is one of the country's leading trial lawyers, with too many honors to list. She was named Lawyer of the Year by the Albuquerque Bar Association and has served on the board of the New Mexico Trial Lawyers Association since 1986. Welcome, Randy McGinn.
Thank you so much for having me, Martha Burke. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start with the basics of the election. This is not going to be like any ordinary election where there are primaries in each party and the winners run against each other in a general election. Tell us about the process in this, what I would call, screwy special election.
It's not a very democratic way to do it. What they are doing is they are having about a little less than 200 people who are people who've been elected to the State Central Committee for CD1 pick the candidate. And that is the rule that was in effect when Deb announced that she was going to go on to be confirmed for the Secretary of the Interior. And so that's the way it's going to work. And that will take place on Tuesday. That's when the election will take place. And then whoever comes out of that with 51% of the SCC votes will have to run in a general election within 60 days. So it's very fast. It happens very, very quickly. And hopefully whatever candidate, then hopefully, I'm hoping it's me, comes out of the SCC meeting, just has a very short general election to the general to win the CD1 seat.
So the Central Committee basically is going to pick the Democratic candidate.
That's correct.
And does it work the same way on the Republican side?
It does.
As I mentioned in the intro, you've had a lot of honors as a trial lawyer, and I would encourage people to go to your website and take a look. But you've never run for public office, to my knowledge. What made you decide to run now?
I've been involved in Democratic politics my whole life, including helping found Emerge New Mexico about 16 years ago, which recruited, trained, and encouraged women to run for office. But I never wanted to run myself until the last 4 years of the last administration. And even though I'd been involved in politics, I guess I was kind of naive. I thought that if some horrible president got elected, that the adults in the room would keep him from destroying the country. And watched in horror along with a lot of us as that did not happen, and that they let him smash everything in sight that I cared about in our democracy. Watching that activated me in a way that I had not been activated before. And I said, I've got to do something more, not just to hold people accountable for all the horrible things they did during this corrupt administration, but to try to rebuild some of the guardrails for democracy so that this kind of thing could never happen again. That's what motivated me to run for Congress when this came open.
Well, I know there are many, many things that former President Trump did that were absolutely unprecedented. But of course, what's on everybody's mind now is he's claiming that the election was stolen from him. And there are now many Republicans particularly in the so-called red states, are trying to limit voting rights. What do you think, as a member of the U.S. House, you would be able to do? What can the House do to stop that momentum?
Well, they've already started it. They passed in the last week or so H.R. 1, which is a voting protection bill, which prevents some of the things that are going on in state legislatures around the country. I think there are over 250 bills that have been proposed since the last election in 43 different states to try to curtail early voting, stop mail-in voting, not allow same-day registration. And H.R. 1, the bill that just was passed, would prevent them from doing those things and would allow same-day registration and mail-in voting and extended voting hours for people. And so that bill has already been passed and now just needs to get through the Senate. And the only hope of that, of course, is if they change the filibuster rules, because the Republicans know they don't want people to vote or they might lose again. But there are two other acts as well. One is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which should be passed and has similar protections, and then also the Native American Voting Rights Act. Since tribes have started to gain political power and many tribes vote Democratic, they are now trying to do the same thing on the reservation that they're doing in the South, that is, cut down the number of polling sites and prevent early voting. And so that act is now needed to protect voting on the reservation as well.
What are some of your other priorities for the state of New Mexico specifically, should you be elected to the U.S. House?
Well, we need, I think, on the heels of the American Rescue Plan, we need a huge infrastructure package. You know, we haven't done infrastructure in this country since World War II. And that infrastructure package should contain a lot of things that would be helpful for New Mexico, things like broadband, money to create a green economy here in New Mexico, to build solar arrays and community solar, and to build wind farms. And those kinds of projects would do wonders here in New Mexico. Because of our abundant sun and wind, we should be one of the leaders in the country on green energy jobs. And an infrastructure package like that would help bring jobs and money back to New Mexico.
And, of course, there's a lot of criticism of the so-called Green New Deal. Some people talk about it as if it's already passed. It certainly has not, but it is a very progressive deal. And some people claim that it's going to kill the oil and gas industry. That is particularly important for New Mexico. What do you have to say about those criticisms?
Well, I think the oil and gas industry in New Mexico kind of has a stranglehold on our economy because it provides 25% to 33% of the tax revenue that provides for education and other things for the state. But in fact, the writing is on the wall for the oil and gas industry. GM has just announced that by 2030, they're going to have all electric cars. If that doesn't send a shiver down the oil and gas industry's backside, I don't know what would. And it seems to me that what's needed is for the state to sit down with the oil and gas industry and have a heart-to-heart talk about how they're on the way out, that they're going to be dinosaurs, that green energy is coming. And they can either sit down with the state and try to transition from an oil and gas economy to a green economy, which will take some time, by the way. It doesn't happen overnight. And if they sit down and work with the state, that the state will do something like it did with the Energy Transition Act last year with PNM, that the state will help subsidize some of those transitions, including retraining workers in the oil and gas fields for other kinds of jobs, whether that's green energy jobs or whether that's other kinds of building trades jobs. So that, I think, is the approach. And I think the big oil companies actually recognize that they may have a dying industry here and have already started to invest in solar and wind and things. And those kind of jobs for New Mexico are wonderful jobs. And I don't know if you've ever been through little Corona, New Mexico up north, a little tiny dot that you blink and you don't even see it. And right now they have a wind farm project up there going on that has transformed this little tiny town into sort of a boom town with all kinds of trailers. They had to run in infrastructure with broadband so that the workers could get internet. And it has been a huge, huge boon for little Corona, New Mexico, and it could do the same all around the state of New Mexico.
Well, speaking of jobs, the new president, Joe Biden, is a strong supporter of working people, particularly those in unions. How do you mesh with his views on that? And you've already addressed some jobs in terms of green energy, but we have a lot of other low-wage workers in this state. How would you look at things that would improve the lives of just, let's say, the ordinary workers?
My grandfather was a union machinist from Philadelphia who helped build the Panama Canal. And I am a strong union supporter and support, again, one of the bills that they've just passed in the last week or two, the PRO Act, which would strengthen collective bargaining and would strengthen enforcement of NLRB rules for union members. And there hasn't been an equal playing field for years. All of the money and efforts have gone to the top. And thank goodness, under the Biden-Harris administration, we are now seeing a turnabout. They're trying to turn around this giant aircraft carrier that's the United States, and they're turning it back towards providing the benefits not to the top, but the people on the bottom and the people who are working people. And that, I think, is a great, great thing. That you look at the American Rescue Plan that just came out, one of the greatest benefits is the child tax credit, which used to only pay families if somebody in the family was working, but now will actually pay money to poor families who don't have jobs or who make less than a certain amount to try to eradicate child poverty on the bottom end of the scale. And it is hoped that that provision of that act will cut child poverty by 40 to 50%. And I think here in New Mexico, it will cut child poverty by even more than that.
Tell us about sort of the longer term issues that we would have to do to improve the state of our kids, and especially in New Mexico.
So the current form of the American Rescue Plan is only for, it's about a year or two, I think, is what they're going to do the child tax credit. But I think of it as an experiment in good government. And if it works to reduce child poverty, my hope is that Congress can make it a permanent benefit to continue to keep child poverty down in the country and in New Mexico in particular. The other thing that would help our New Mexico kids is, of course, getting broadband to the 20% of our Indian lands and rural areas that don't even have internet.
You're listening to KSFR's Equal Time. I'm Martha Burke, and my guest today is Randy McGann, Democratic candidate for U.S. Representative in New Mexico's District 1. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but you did mention the filibuster, and you've mentioned passing several bills. And as we know, the Senate right now, there is a filibuster rule for the benefit of our listeners who aren't so familiar with the ins and outs of this. That means that many bills, if not most in the U.S. Senate, cannot pass by a simple majority unless the Republicans agree to it, because most bills require a supermajority of 60% if the opposition party insists on it, and that's called the filibuster. Some people are trying to abolish it. What do you think the chances are?
I thought they were lower than I think now, because at the beginning, both Joe Biden and somebody like Joe Manchin were saying we're not going to abolish the filibuster, but the Republicans are making the best case for its abolishment by being obstructionist. The fact that not a single Republican voted for the American Rescue Plan, even though a huge majority of even their own constituents supported this plan, sort of makes the case for how they don't care about the people, the Democrats do, and that you've got to get these bold things done. And so to do that, you've got to get rid of the filibuster. And so you're hearing both Joe Biden now and Joe Manchin say, we're willing to talk about reforms of the filibuster. That is, you know, it used to be that, like the Jimmy Stewart movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you had to actually stand up and hold the floor and talk for hours to keep the filibuster going. And they changed that rule. So all you have to do is just announce you're going to filibuster and you don't have to do anything. And one of the things they proposed is they're not going to do that anymore. They're going to make you have to stand up there for days and talk if you want to try to delay legislation. And so I think you're seeing some changes in people's willingness to get rid of the filibuster. And if that's the only way to get some of the things we need to get done to transform government done, then I think they need to get rid of it.
Let's talk a little bit about health care. Republicans have been trying to get rid of Obamacare since it was first launched. And even with it, a lot of people, as we know, can't afford decent health care. And it's particularly important now because of COVID. In a perfect world, what would you do and what do you plan to do in the U.S. House to help change or improve the health care shortfall that we still have?
We've learned something from the pandemic, haven't we? And there is always opportunity in crises like the pandemic. And what we've learned is that health care tied to your job doesn't work in a pandemic when you lose your job through no fault of your own because they've shut down all the business. And that's a powerful lesson for people to know. And the second thing we've learned is that one person can infect the entire world. And so maybe that person should have health care and their family should have health care to protect all of the rest of us. Having health care for all means that everybody is protected from this kind of pandemic and this kind of disease. And so I think the time is right coming off of the pandemic for the first time to try to push something closer to universal health care. And Joe Biden, again, sort of has started off by trying to bolster up Obamacare. But I think in Congress, I would like to, along with other people, start moving from Obamacare to more of a universal health care kind of program, or what some people call Medicare for all, because that's the only thing that really works to get everybody covered.
And that would be basically, for the benefit of some of our listeners who may not follow this as closely, it wouldn't be totally free. It would be like Medicare, where people do pay premiums, but they are guaranteed that they can pay premiums and get covered, which is one of the big problems now with many insurance companies. And I want to move back to the low-wage business again because of New Mexico. The Rescue and Recovery Act that we've been talking about that passed in the last weeks or 10 days had in it a raise of the minimum wage. National minimum wage right now is at $7.25 an hour. I would challenge anybody to actually live on that. And there was a minimum wage raise in the bill that got struck because everyone knew the Republicans would not go along with it. It was going to be $15 an hour. What do you think about raising the minimum? How do we do it? When can we do it?
Okay, well, once again, I mean, by the way, the regular minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, but there is something called the sub-minimum wage, which is for wait staff, waitresses, people who work in restaurants. And that rate is $2.13 an hour. And that rate, of course, primarily affects women and women of color who work in food services industries. And that's even more outrageous than the $7.25. So again, going back to the pandemic, we now have a new term that we've never had before, which is the term essential workers. And what did we learn from the pandemic? That the workers who are most essential for keeping all of us alive, the person checking out your groceries or stocking your groceries or delivering packages to your house, are the people that risk their lives to keep us all alive, but are the people that we pay the least to. And instead of just saying thank you to them, which is inadequate, we should pay them a living wage. And so I think in order for us to win the midterms, we have to introduce a bill, that is, the Democrats have to introduce and pass a bill that finally raises the minimum wage to $15, which, by the way, was the rate they proposed 12 years ago when this first came up as being a living wage to 12 years ago. And the other key thing, and I would abolish the sub-minimum wage so that everybody gets paid at least $15 an hour. And the other key thing is to add a cost of living increase to the $15 an hour minimum wage, because so that you don't have this fight every year with businesses saying don't raise the minimum wage, and that it just automatically raises from then on and we don't have to have this fight over and over and over again. So that's what I would do.
Well, you've mentioned how hard this has been on women, particularly women of color. And it definitely has. The COVID crisis has. Women have lost most of the jobs, not least because it's like a snowball rolling down a hill. First of all, if you're a two-parent family and the kids can't go to school, somebody's got to quit to take care of the kids. Who's that going to be? The lower earner in the family, usually the woman, because of the national pay gap, which is about 22 cents on the dollar what women make overall. Women of color, a lot less. If you're a single mother, it's even worse. Again, mostly women of color, because you may have to go on public assistance, food stamps, Medicaid, because you got nobody to take care of the kids. And that is because, of course, we don't have any daycare in this country. So all of that rolls into one big problem for women. How would you address the daycare issue first? And the fact that women are still, even after the Equal Pay Act was passed way back in 1963, we are still way behind men in overall wages.
It's all of a piece, isn't it? I mean, yes. you have to do it all at the same time. And so, somebody asked me in one of these forums, what's your priorities and in what order would you do them? And I said, you know, the truth is you've got to do them all at the same time because they're so interconnected. So you have to get health care for everybody. You have to get paid sick leave so that women don't lose their jobs because they have to go home and stay home with a kid who has to be on online school or who's sick. And then you also have to make sure that women get paid the same as men. And then you have to have daycare. And the most essential workers of all, as it turns out in this pandemic, the people who have kept our country running so that women could go to work are, of course, our teachers. And we have to make sure we protect them. It is troubling to me that because of the economy, teachers are being pushed back into the classroom and ordered back into the classroom. Here in New Mexico, they're going to open up April 5th without giving them a choice about whether they feel safe or not. And that's before all of them have been vaccinated and don't have personal protective equipment. It concerns me that we are not first looking out for the welfare of the educators that make working people possible. And I understand it. Again, it's a very complex problem. They want to get the teachers back so that people can go back to work, but they're putting the teachers at risk to do that. And I would urge people to try to get the teachers vaccinated and move them up the list so they can get vaccinated first before you put them back in the classroom. And the same is true for all the people who work in the schools, social workers and nurses and the people in the cafeteria should all be vaccinated before they have to go back into the classroom.
Our time is almost out, but I do want you to address briefly, because it's huge now, it's going to be huge. The United States House is narrowly divided between the Democrats have a majority, but not a huge one, loss of a few votes, and they're not going to be able to get anything done. We've talked about the obstruction in the Senate because of the filibuster there. The Democrats only have a one-vote majority, and that's if Vice President Harris breaks a tie. How would you solve the problem of the parties not cooperating? How can you reach across the aisle?
Well, that's something I've done my whole career as a lawyer. In cases where I've sued somebody, and so they don't like me very much to start off with. Sometimes they even hate me for having filed suit against them. And even in that situation, I've had to work with the other side to try to come to some resolution of the case. And I've pioneered something that I called transformative law. So in my lawsuits, where usually the worst thing in somebody's life has happened, one of their loved ones has been killed, a child's been killed, somebody's been made a paraplegic or a quadriplegic, it's been my experience, it's never about just the money, that the person who's hurt or the family member who's lost someone wants changes so that this kind of thing never happens to anybody else. And so over the years, negotiating with people who don't like me very much, we've managed to get giant corporations, some of the largest in the country, to make changes that made the community safer. Things like redesigning products that were unsafe, retraining medical workers who missed a breathing problem that caused someone to be brain injured, creating memorials for lost loved ones, doing things that actually changes things in the community to make it safer. And that's the kind of negotiation skills that I've honed over 40 years. And if I can do that with giant corporations, I can do that, I think, in the Senate and the Congress, and even talk to senators, I mean, to try to convince them to do the right thing. It's, of course, it's always a combination of the carrot and the stick. You know, you, and then the use of persuasion and messaging to convince them to do the right thing. And I think that's possible. I think it's possible, and if not with them, then with the voting public, to convince people that our ideas on the progressive side of the Democratic Party are not radical. They're just right.
That has to be the last word. My guest today was Randy McGinn, who is running for the U.S. House seat in Congressional District 1 in New Mexico. For KSFR's Equal Time, I'm Martha Burke.